Welcome to Symptomatic Redness with me, Amogh Sahu.
And me, Derek Warren.
Right. So this time we're talking about a number of things, but mainly Marxism and its relationship to religion. So the reason I thought this was an interesting topic is because, you know, the traditional SR method is to take some sort of like philosophical point of remove from existing left book debates for good reason, and try and grapple with sort of these fundamental methodological questions involved in left theory and other things. So I take us to be kind of circling around three questions, none of which we're going to answer completely. So the first question is, does Marxism have a coherent ethics? Does it have an adequate account of human consciousness? You know, by consciousness, I just mean superstructural stuff. And also, the third question, you know, to what extent is Marxism guilty of idealism? And by idealism, I understand something like mystifying actual social dynamics, you know, the actual social world, by imposing these philosophical constructs on them. I take religion and Marxism's relationship to religion to be an interesting way of dealing with all these three questions. Because religion and religious discourse, as we know, is kind of intimately connected to ethical discourse, right? And religion plays this special role in Marxist thought about human consciousness, in the sense of, you know, anyone who, any kind of class of opponents of Marxism who reify some part of the superstructure, be it politics or culture or religion, and treat it as kind of having independent causal power, is accused, like, quite, you know, again and again and again, of being, of mystifying, of being essentially religious. So I think it's useful.
But it's interesting, as a side note, though, that the two biggest sins of Marxism seems to be economism on one hand, which you would think would be okay, right? Idea that there would be a natural economic development to these stages. And that actually, weirdly, is both in Bernstein and Stalin, even though you can't get people more different in what they saw things at. But like the Stalinist reading of The Science of Logic in Hegel paints economic development as necessarily leading to communism, not just like it, you know, it not just as a contradiction, but as, you know, as an into, as one into a contradiction, or maybe the into a contradiction,
right?
But as a necessary thing that has to happen no matter what,
right? And that would be if any Marxism is guilty of idealism, it would be that sort of Marxism, right? Where it's like,
right,
here are these philosophical conceptual categories. I mean, you can get into, we'll probably get into how Lukács is doing this later, right? But it's like, here are these philosophical categories, and we're going to use them for sociology.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, and I mean, I literally just did a 2-hour-long podcast on Lukács's, like, the what's good in Lukács, but that assumption in Lukács is a huge problem.
Right.
And he hides it in terminology conflation.
Right.
So, you know, like, the fact that you can interpret, like, when we were talking about, if you interpret consciousness as a sort of objective awareness of the logics of class and capital,
right,
you know, and of your long-term time preferences versus your short-term ones,
right,
that makes perfect sense until you get to the fact that all the predictions he made off that don't hold up. And if you try to maintain his predictions, then you can't have that reading of what he means by consciousness, because he starts talking about authenticity.
Right.
And that becomes a problem. And, you know, I think it's interesting that we want to talk about the Marxist relationship to religion and mystification and the base superstructure stuff through Alistair McIntyre.
Mm-hmm.
Is going to be the primary one. We're also going to talk about a kind of more post-structural, more Badouian, you know, thinker, Alberto Toscano.
Right.
famous for the book Fanaticism.
Yeah, right. Yeah, no, that's right. So the final reason, and we already touched on it, why religion is particularly interesting is that, you know, standard kind of rhetorical pose that Marxist discourse conducts is to treat itself as science and any competing account of human life and the structure of human life, even one which doesn't have the same aims of prediction as religious. Right?
And or idealism, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And the idealism has a quasi-religious implication to it.
Right. So religion doesn't simply have this kind of like... It isn't simply about getting the prediction wrong. It's also about having the wrong concepts to think about social life. Right.
Right.
So this is particularly ironic because, like, a lot of people, including, I suppose, the two of us, would say that the Marxist discourse has lost its claim to science, if it ever had one, and, you know, become its own religion.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I have taken to the Lukashian... I have taken to the, not Lukashian, Lakatoshian perspective, and also a perspective that, you know, will get me in trouble, but comes out of my training from the Platypus Affiliated Society. And I'll just mention them together. One, that the research project of the left is degenerated, and that the terms are no longer clear in our use, so that we can talk past each other about terms. I was mentioning it the other day. A friend of mine was talking about how Wallerstein and somebody was white and E.M. Rhodes was wrong. And then I pointed out that some of the critiques of E.M. Woods and Robert Brenner, even though there are issues with Robert Brenner and E.M. Woods, that they didn't actually, they weren't talking about the same thing. That what one was describing as capitalism had a different definition than the other, and that Marx, methodologically operating from this sense of Hegelianism, he doesn't define terms first. It does not operate that way. So you start off with a critique and description, and then you get to the terminological meanings from that critique, and you actually sort of build up. So, you know, it's the same way the phenomenology works or the science of logic. I'm not saying it's the same thing. I actually think it's very different, and particularly if you read some of Marx's unpublished stuff on Hegel, that there is a methodology there where you don't start from definitions. You start from problems and contradictions and work out what things are from that. And then you sort of state the contradictions. You actually don't define the thing. So like, Marx doesn't actually... Like, somebody, as was Lukács, who says, Marx never defines class. And then Draper points out that Marx actually doesn't define capitalism. He describes its political economy, but he never actually defines what it is. But you can deduce from Marx's description... And the way he sets out his value theory, like what the criterion of capital is, right?
Right.
So when you deal with these concepts like religion, you're dealing with the same problem, and a lot of Marxists have lost sight of that in trying to clarify their own theories, either for political necessity back when actually existentially socialism was a thing, or from, you know, some actually lately from academic needs of working within academia and writing in that style, because working from that methodological perspective would not be accepted in academia. And furthermore, there's a tendency to try to say that Marx and Engels don't make kind of empirical errors, particularly Engels. Like, I pointed out that there's passages in A Dialectics of Nature that the simple reading is Lamarckian, and thus wrong.
Right.
And if you really try, you can come up with a complex reading where it's not that, but the complex reading is very obscure. So to re-inject religion into it, it's interesting having someone like McIntyre point out that there's still a whole lot of dialectical tension, let's put it that way, between Christianity and Marxism. And I have noticed there's been a tendency of Hegel scholars recently to try to, I think, deny the obvious. I was hearing someone like, Hegel was interested in the dialectic between spirituality and materialism, but he wasn't really religious. And I'm like, and that he only went to church for political pressure. And I'm like, you have to ignore most of his lectures outside of the phenomenology and the science of logic to believe that. Like most of his work goes another way. And it's also clear to pretty much every, like, pre-1990s scholar, and most scholars and most philologists of German idealism, that Christianity, even if Hegel's version of Christianity is non-standard and maybe quasi-heretical, that he definitely thought he was playing with the Lutheran notion of freedom opening up over time. And he even says that in the lectures on the history of religion.
He says this. He actually says it many, many times in the Logic. The absolute is supposed to be God. And he downright, like, he makes some version of the ontological argument at some point, but anyway, that's not, yeah.
Right, I mean, he just defines God's manifestation through negativity, but people try to take that as him saying that God is a void, and I'm like, no, that's...
Yeah, I mean, I guess the thought is, the question is, like, one of the reasons Hegel avoids the religious, or people who like Hegel avoid the religious charge, is because they take, you know, calling someone theological is like a de facto insult. It's this horrible,
right?
And I suppose the question is why. And I say this not to, you know, endorse religion. It's just good to get a sense of what precisely is being alleged when we call someone, you know,
yeah,
a theist, other than the obvious that they believe in God.
It just seems funny to me, because I think what the issue is you're right, is people think religion has no serious academic discourse. Therefore, if we say Hegel is an explicitly a religious philosopher, it is like calling him, you know, Thomas Aquinas. And you see this more and more over
and
a
what's
long
wrong
time.
With Thomas Aquinas? I mean, you know.
yeah, but you see this more and more even from the the Leo Straussian view of the world, which is weird because people would not think they're doing that. But Strauss read, you know, all the ancients as having, you know, a conservative but secret secular liberalism going all the way back to Aristotle that's been, and even Plato, that's
right,
been deliberately made esoteric.
Right.
And that they're all really secular humanist, kind of.
Right.
Like, that's a Straussian reading.
Right. I mean, I'm not even sure what's at stake in the God debate anymore. I mean, it's like, you know, there's this, people think that what it means to be religious, at least in the Marxist context, is to, like, have bad social science. Right? It's like, what it means to be religious is to, like, invoke shitty explanations for things.
But I think you actually do have to think a little bit about what's at stake here. I mean, one of the things about it is that one has to decide what secularity has to do with it in some ways. And one of the things that I have come to the conclusion of is the way we think about secularity is Christian, actually,
right,
itself. And that the God debate now between, you know, fundamentalists and new atheists is in some ways similar to, like, the Judaizing debates of the,
right,
the 5th century.
Right.
Like, it's two people who share a background trying to obscure the background they share by overstating the differences. And I do think there's a whole lot of naturalization of Christian ethics going on. So this brings me, why did you, normally I pick the text or the topic, you
right
did today, why
yeah
did you have me read these? And I love, as a side note, I love Alastair McIntyre. Of the Catholic philosophers I've read,
right,
he's my favorite.
Right.
particularly modern ones. But why did you want us to read the three texts that I read for this and state right. them and state, you know, what
no
was
problem.
Your motivation?
Yeah, I was just about to do that. So the Toscano text, which is Real Abstractions, Marx's Critique of Religion, I thought that was going to be sort of a sort of interesting summary slash defense of Marx's critique of religion, and I didn't take that to be an interesting expression of a point of view when I initially assigned it. After looking through it, it's a bit my opinion's changed a bit. A lot of it is just sort of Marx scholarship and Marxology. Like half of it is, you know, quotes of Marx relating to religion. And I thought that would be like a nice, you know, summary that we could just have of Marx's critique of religion. The McIntyre I took to have this kind of reverse effect. It's this kind of like religious critique of Marx. I mean, I put religious in quote marks, but, you know, this kind of critique of Marx from a religious perspective. You know, as Marx criticizes religion for being a mystification, and we'll get into what that means. McIntyre criticizes Marxism for a number of things, ranging from, you know, its inability to provide a coherent ethics, its inability to kind of aim towards some conception of the good. There's also some critique which is going to be like particularly relevant to you right now, Derek, which is this critique that it isn't able to use religious vocabulary for political mobilization. Right, so it's like Toscano goes into some detail about how Marx, you know, not only rejects, you know, any sort of doctrinaire, theistic, metaphysical version of Christianity. He also rejects Christian socialism, and, you know, uses of Christian ethical language. Whether or not he himself is doing it is another question. The uses of Christian ethical language in order to guide socialism. And McIntyre thinks this is a mistake. It isn't just a mistake philosophically, it's also a mistake in terms of, the mobilization of people towards a conception of the good. So the reason I wanted us to talk through these texts is because thinking through this problem of religion, I think, has these kind of interesting broader implications for Marxism. So that was my idea.
Right, so one of the things I've been fascinated in recently is the idea that Marxism is not supposed to be a philosophical doctrine. It's not, it is supposed to be a, one, I mean, there isn't a Marxism in Marx, for one thing, but Marxism, right, even in Engels, is supposed to be a scientific doctrine. But to clarify that, you have to clarify what science is, and I mean, I'm not the first person to point out that the word they use for science in German is actually not exactly the equivalent to the word we would use. It doesn't have the Baconian background,
mm-hmm,
and it means something like more like objective knowledge, and it also has to do with the fact that Marxist materialism aims to complicate empiricism, or even the Baconian scientific method. And I have said before, the Baconian scientific method is almost a dialectic solving of the idealist empirical problem. Because what that attempts to do, and I'm going to complicate that in a minute, as of everyone who studied philosophy of science knows, science doesn't actually work in the Baconian method. But what the Baconian method is a myth of is a way to take the ideal rigors of logic, but, you know, and math, those are idealistic, actually. I mean, I don't mean, like, idealistic and, like, oh, hurtful for a new tomorrow. I mean, like, they are literally axiomatically ideal. They are a way of talking about, quote-unquote, real abstractions, which are Platonic. And this is why even anti-Marxist thinkers like Kolakowski, you know, when he was a Marxist, interestingly, before he denounced it later, when he wrote Main Currents of Marxism, he started off, he was still a Marxist, and when he finished the book, he, like, hated everything.
Right.
But he starts off the history with Plotinus, You know, like he sees it as a development out of, even when he was still in it, as a development out of idealism.
You right.
know, and idealism tracing itself back all the way to Neoplatonism.
Right.
And I think that's a little bit of a stretch, but I do think that the MacIntyre points out, particularly when MacIntyre talks about the profundity of the theses of Feuerbach, which he keeps coming back to as, you know, both where Marx is most interesting and where he seems to think Marx went wrong. Because he talks about how Marx points out the superficialness of the Feuerbachian and left Hegelian, you know, reading of religion over and over again. I mean, MacIntyre seems to come back to that. I mean, he's Catholic. He would. And the other thing is MacIntyre seems to think that there is a real relationship between the Marxist view of philosophical, you know, structures emerging out of material conditions, but that view still does posit that intellectual traditions matter and have a real basis, which is interesting to think
right.
about, because a lot of Marxists would throw that out.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely... one way we could just get started out is by talking about materialism. And the extent to which we're supposed to take it as a set of claims about not just philosophy, a set of claims about the nature of human the nature of human mind, all this kind of stuff, is all encompassing philosophy, and that's actually not really how it's used in either in Marxist texts, which are read a lot, or in I was about to say left book, but I mean. Not, I don't mean left book. I mean sort of, ongoing strands of Marxist discourse. Like, Marxism has survived, if it's survived at all, mainly as a social science.
You have it on one end and the conservative French sociology on the other.
Right.
Basically being the foundation of sociology.
Right. But if you look at the materialist philosophical program, the part of the reason people drop it is because it's pretty implausible. So, I mean, I should say why I think that before going on. The initial materialist program, and this is my reading of things like the German ideology and critique of Hegel's philosophy in general, was that the primary sort of relationship between human subjects and the world that they lived in was this relationship of labor, not a contemplative relationship, not as Hegel thought, this kind of intellectual relationship of knowledge between subject and object. It was, the laboring upon nature to produce youth values, and it's just individual people. We labor in modes, and the standard story, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the idea, what gave it its distinctive philosophical import, was that somehow you want to say that all other forms of human mindedness, all other human activities, all other forms of human life somehow fit or mirror or get their structure from the structure of labor, right? And if you take this claim to its extreme, language, thought, reference, all of these, religion, aesthetics, etc., not only are all of these affected by material conditions, which every Marxist believes, and if you read affected broadly enough, every person believes, the idea is that somehow they're supposed to be determined
but conversely, that unlike other materialisms which reduce human beings to automata,
right,
that human freedom still remains paramount.
Right.
And in fact, it is through collectivity that freedom could actually be made manifest non-stochastically.
Right, it's not. So labor is not the atoms that compose people. Labor is this intentional minded relation between people and their environment.
Right. And here's where it gets unclear. Engels took this so far in the Dialectics of Nature as to say, the semi-famous thing that's been interpreted as Lamarckian, that the widening of the human hand had to do with labor.
Right.
And that was the first conscious control of our biological being.
Right.
And that the only separation between man and animal is our ability to be conscious in our direction of our labor in a way that changes us and
right.
gives us true freedom, whereas the animal does not have the subject-object ability. It can't understand itself in a self-reflected way. It can't treat the subject as an object
right.
to change it.
And the distinctive Marxist contribution is that, like, subject-object understanding is first found in labor, not in thought.
Right. So it's not in contemplation, but in actually doing stuff.
Like, right.
And in, but there's a whole lot of things that are complicated in that, because the way Marxists talk about social relationships as being material, and then obscured and mystified and then remanifested in material.
Right.
So if you kind of take it through, you have the development of ideology, and then which is a term that Marx kind of drops later, and then you see it manifested in the commodity fetish and on fetishism in general, where the abstraction is reified into a thing which then actually itself changes the relationship.
Right. But ultimately, if the original program is to work, something roughly like something like the equivalent of this, like, the logical positivist reduction of everything that isn't empirical discourse to empirical discourse, some equivalent has to be true for Marxism. Everything that isn't not the economy, which is the sort of standard misreading, right? Which is some everything which isn't the labor relationship,
and not politics either, which is
right.
another misreading. Like the other, you know, the other sin, and this sin is interesting because I think economism is a sin that everyone complains about, but political determinism is another one where, like, you assume that the control of the state is what manifests everything,
right. It's the mode of production, which is like, which is not the economy, right? The mode of production is supposed to be this. It's very hard to give it an exhaustive definition in terms that we would understand, because it's supposed to be a primitive concept. It does the explaining work, you know. A mode of production is you know, the social way in which we channel our labor.
And which also, though, to not make a Lassallian understanding and misunderstanding, it's more than just our labor at stake. The social relations actually become before labor, weirdly. And this is where things get complicated, because labor is required to maintain ourselves and maintain the society we build, but our labor is channeled before our social relations and also changes them.
Right.
And this is that, like, dialectical tension stuff. But it's also something I think is just observable in life. Like,
well, this is where the use-exchange-value contradiction comes from.
Right. But this is, like, you're jumping ahead.
Right. Yeah.
Like, if there's anything Marx, if there's anything transhistorical in Marxism, and, like, the big debate over whether Marx believes in human nature, for example, like, most people think he doesn't. I tend to think species being is something like human nature, and it's a misreading, but that for him, human nature is not static because of a tendency towards freedom.
Right.
And this is where I actually agree with him. Things change over time, and at a certain point, labor and social structures subsume biological determinism
right.
because of our self-consciousness.
Here's one way to think about it. You might, and this actually he has in common with Hegel. For Marx and Hegel, at least, in, you know, if you take the humanist reading seriously, the good, if insofar as there is a good in human life, the best human life is the most free human life. And the way they understand the notion of freedom is in terms of a set of capacities, a salient set of capacities, being exercised in a free way. Whatever that's, I mean, what's good about that definition is it allows you to plug in what the salient capacities are, right? And these can change over time. Now, the McIntyre, by contrast, is actually going to have a substantive view, or maybe he doesn't have a substantive view, which makes it a bit problematic. How, like, what his beef with Marxism is? Maybe not McIntyre, like theologists. Theological ethics is going to have a substantive transhistorical view about what the human good is. Marxism says something at the very abstract level, but that's completely contentless unless you fill it out with an actual human society or a mode of production.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think part of what McIntyre is going to reject Marxism for is that that McIntyre, frankly, just thinks that materialism's false.
Yeah.
That's ipso facto, like, the assumption that, like, the reason why Marxism doesn't work is that materialism is not true.
Right. So it's important to note that it's not materialism as an explanatory social science. Like, that's not, you know, he doesn't really care about, like, prediction and, like, you know, predictive accuracy.
Yeah, we're not talking about methodological materialism here, right. which is like, you know, analytic science talk.
Right.
Like,
we're
talking about ontological materialism.
Right. And I'm not sure. I think ontological material. See, I'm not sure his criticism is of materialism, but of, you know, this common assumption.
Here's the thing.
Yeah.
Let's go back here.
Sure.
Don't assume our listeners have read this. So,
yeah.
What is McIntyre's exact problem with Marx?
Right.
You know, other than what I just said about materialism, like, because because, for example, one of the things, like, when we were talking, we've talked outside of this about the political social distinction.
Right.
When you talk about res publica or comania politica from Aristotle.
Or civil society.
Civil society and also politic both share a root word. So, like, one of the things that you have to begin it with McIntyre is McIntyre's assumptions are not anti-Hegelian, but they are definitely rooted in Aquinian readings of Aristotle, and that he thinks that there's some mystification going on in Marxism, ironically, about their origins and whatnot. I mean, like, if you look at the thesis on Feuerbach, Rodinat, Taken, which is the last thing you sent me, that's one of the things he starts off with. So,
right.
What is at stake here?
So, I'm actually not sure about the extent to which he is or isn't anti-Hegelian, but we'll get there. So, maybe it's useful to say a little bit about who this McIntyre guy is, you know, and what his broad philosophical outlook is.
McIntyre is a British Catholic who wrote a book that I have found very useful for my personal ethical philosophies.
Who was a Trotskyite? Trotskyite?
But he started off as a Trotskyist, and has continuously re-engaged with Marxism over the course of his career. I mean, interestingly, he writes about, you know, he writes in the, I think in the late 90s, maybe early 2000s, in an essay you gave me about his three, you know, where he explains some insights that he had about his own writings about Marx.
Right.
At a time when Marx was, like, in the context of the late 90s, early 2000s, Marx didn't seem relevant to anyone. And I mean, very little. Like, when I was in college in 99, 2000, 2001, 2002, no one really talked about Marx. We talked about post-Marxism. We talked about all the stuff from France in the 70s that was beyond Marxism, but we did not talk about Marx very much. You'd read the Communist Manifesto as, like, something above a utopian document and then never go back to it again.
Right.
And you know, people would tell you to go read Capital so you could understand the MCM, frankly, misreadings and Deleuze and all that. But you would not get, you would not read a lot of Marx, you know.
Right.
I mean, like, you know, one of the hot books when I was in university was Spectres of Marx by Derrida, which, you know, it's kind of like we treat Marx as an important thinker, but postmodernism has made him irrelevant. And what is interesting to me is sort of the revenge of Hegel and Marx since I graduated, right? Part of it was the economic crisis. Part of it is, I think, postmodernism just didn't really go anywhere. So, you know, even though I think Foucault and Heidegger are still widely taken seriously and discussed, but like, Derrida was already falling out of favor when he died.
And right.
That wasn't that long ago, but it, you know, was big.
Yeah.
And so now we have a completely different set of assumptions in approaching this. So I think, you know, to make this clear when we're talking about this, McIntyre talks about secular virtues as being thin in the after virtue, that liberalism doesn't have a robust enough theory of the ethical for ethics to make sense, and that both ethical systems it produced, Kantian deontology and
existentialism, emotivism, all this.
Existentialism, emotivism, and oh my god, utilitarianism are all in some ways vapid, because they are attempts to remove a historical tradition, you know, and a pluralist view of the world. From hand, and his other important thing is not just pluralism, though, that each pluralism, like each ethical set, has to be rooted in a living tradition, and, you know,
right.
And he validates many of them, but of course his favorite is the one of his religion, which is kind of quasi Aristotelian Catholic ethics, right?
Just a side note on the pluralism. One of the things about McIntyre's ethics is that he is pluralistic methodologically. He thinks that, you know, you can only talk about the good relative to a tradition of virtue, all that kind of stuff. But if you look at his proposal, if you look at what he wants to bring about, he is in some way resolutely non-pluralistic, right? When we have this kind of, like, you know, the new reign of the Aristotle Aquinas Catholic World League or whatever the hell he wants, right? It's like, the good thing about that is that people are going to have this embodied tradition which is going to inform them about the good. There isn't going to be, like, 50,000 different equally valid plural discourses about the good.
No, but...
So in that sense, he's not
pluralistic. Conservative pluralism is always like that, though. I mean, like,
right.
He's not the only one who thinks that. The thing is about that is they... The thing is about those traditions, that those traditions take virtues too generously. So let's really break that down and maybe get to how it could possibly relate to Marx. So, like, charity is a virtue that is a good. It has a tradition. It develops in time. Bravery is a virtue that is a good.
Friendship.
Friendship, whatever, right? But these things have defined definitions that have historical traditions that have developed from their instantiation, and then from their instantiation Aristotle, and their clarification from Revelation and Christianity. That's the way McIntyre would understand it. But that each of these things are sui generis, and that they can conflict. That's important.
Right,
right?
So pluralism within a tradition.
Right.
But not.
It is not a postmodernist, everyone can be right pluralism. It is a pluralism that allows for multiple views, interpretations, and world beings, even, but very grounded in a embodied tradition and an embodied faith. Now, that's. And if you think about the way the Catholic Church works with, like, sometimes dramatically opposed theological orders, as long as they don't dip into heresy.
Right.
That makes sense, right? Because the Catholic Church is always, in the Orthodox Church in a different way, always trying to be theological big tent unless you push it too far. It, right. You know, because, you know, reason can conflict with itself, but it can have different focuses. And, you know, I have actually said in the past that, like, my model for what a political party actually would look like that was ideal would be something like the Catholic Church.
Right.
And that it allows for particularity in a universal structure. And that tension for particularity and universalism is played out by the fact that for example, Revelation and the Catholic Church has, there's two ways for it to come out: ex cathedra by the Pope about dogma, or through ecumenical councils. Which what makes ecumenical councils miraculous is that you get all the factions of a church to agree on something. Like, that is the miracle. I'm being serious.
No, I know, yeah.
Like, it's funny, but I'm being serious. Like,
that's right.
That's how it works.
Right.
And McIntyre is sort of trying to intellectually ground this in a sound, you know, both Aristotelian, but he actually is also trying to appeal to outsiders by making it historical.
Right.
Right. He's trying to, like, say, look, this develops in history. It, to use a Christian way, is revealed in history. And these static liberal worldviews that deny historical revelation, even though they, quote-unquote, believe in progress, have to do so on a shallow ground that doesn't have any, you know, traditional embodiment. And I actually think it does kind of, I do think some of the criticisms that he's short-selling the liberal tradition is true. There are liberal traditions, plural.
Right.
Is that he is sort of short-selling it. But he does, I actually think he is sort of damning to dominant trends in thinking where a sort of idealist deontology rule they fall apart. Or utilitarianism. To me, utilitarianism is like, it is superficially defensible until, you know, you think about it.
Like, right.
It makes a lot of sense if you have a very superficial understanding of it, and it makes no sense if you actually profoundly think it out. Although I will say that in some ways antinatalism is a logical conclusion of it, as is some other things, because if the certainty of pain from a utilitarian, like, nothingness would be better than pain, so like bringing nothing into being would actually be the preferred way to be.
I think McIntyre's thought would be, it isn't even that you launch these kind of like philosophical critiques of these ethical systems. It's that if you look at them closely enough, they don't actually do what they set out to do, which is to provide you guidance, right? Which is that, you know, ultimately utilitarianism is vacuous because you set up the utility function how you want, or you set up the utility function according to, I don't know, the set of social norms you have, a set of Christian values you've inherited, etc., etc., in which case utilitarianism itself isn't actually doing very much ethical work. Ditto with Kantian deontology, ditto with emotivism, ditto with all of this stuff. It actually doesn't help you as a concrete human being living in a particular historical period. Yeah, I mean, maybe let me say a little bit about why I think, I think McIntyre's immediate target is both Hegel and Marx, because I take, you know, I think that McIntyre thinks, at least for the more humanist Marx, that the ethics they have, the ethics that they provide, in the end isn't itself historically rooted in the right way, because it's dependent fundamentally on this notion of freedom, freedom as understood in terms of, you know, in Marx's case, the free exercise of labor in communism, but freedom in Hegel's case meaning, I don't know, the achievement of the absolute through the rational state, and freedom across, you know, across the Marxist tradition, you know, Lukács, the end of reification, Adorno, although for Adorno, freedom is never possible, etc., etc. You know, so McIntyre's issue with that is that ultimately, the mistake the Marxist tradition makes, the same mistake as the liberal tradition. It's a very standard conservative criticism, right? It's that ultimately you don't commit to a sort of robust notion of the good, which is actually able to make you, it's actually able to allow you to make certain choices. You don't have this living tradition of the good, which is able to tell you, do this, don't do that. Or even if it's not able to tell you that, it's able to like train you in a certain way to be able to judge, you know, in when situations conflict.
So why is McIntyre so much more willing? I mean, in a weird way, not just because he was Trotskyist, McIntyre seems so much more willing to say, like, Marxism's been undersold, and it's wrong, but it's wrong for a much more profound reason than its liberal critics or even the many other religious critics have pointed out. Like, because he does seem to take Marxism more seriously than the rest of the liberal tradition, even though he does seem to think that Marxism emerges out of it, which I think is an objective fact. Like,
right.
Marxism is a critique of liberalism, but it emerges from it.
Right. So the foundations of Hegel's system, you know, Hegel is an important communications with Kant, Marx is an important communications with Hegel, you know, that line doesn't entirely break, is that? Mm-hmm. Right? And ultimately, I think the thought's going to be that Marxism gets things methodologically right, because if it, like McIntyre's preferred version of virtue ethics, focuses on embodiment, it focuses on the fact that human beings are rational animals, but dependent rational animals, this is McIntyre's phrase, right? You know, we have the ability to think outside our circumstances, think universally, but in such a way as is always tethered to our historical period. McIntyre likes that in Marx. What he doesn't like is the fact that Marxism ultimately has this very reductive approach to ethics, either a reductive approach to ethics if you take the sort of anti-humanist reading, or when it
no
actually
ethics
does
at all.
Yeah, no ethics at all, or Hegelianism, Kantianism. Hegelianism, Kantianism with labor as the main relation.
Right. So he not just reductive, like he calls it reductive, but let's be honest, if you take Marxism at its claims, there isn't an ethical
right
element of it. Let's be serious here.
If you take the materialist program on its own terms seriously, yeah, that's right.
Right, like even I have said, like, the idea that exploitation is a problem does seem to have an ethical component.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's something that McIntyre points out, that, like, if you are completely divorced from any ethical traditions, some of the things that Marx points out as contradictions aren't.
Right. I mean, ultimately, a bunch of it is, it rests on telos claims, right? It's a mode of production is structured so as to satisfy human needs, but it doesn't do that. That's the contradiction.
Right. And maybe this is why McIntyre respects it, though, because Aristotelian teleology has a lingering presence,
right?
Not in the postmodern critique of there is a necessary teleos. Although I think most Marxists do probably think there is a necessary teleos,
but it's not necessary to the view. Yeah,
right. It's not necessary to the view, but in the sense that stuff does stuff because it's designed to do stuff,
right?
In the most reductor ad absurdum of what that means, like, there are teleologies, there are logics, there are consciousnesses, to use the various,
right,
you know, phrases that different Marxists have used for this, of society, you know, and that the problem with capitalism, in specific, and with liberalism in general, is that it makes a promise about human freedom that its structure necessarily means you cannot completely deliver on.
Right. I mean, you can take, you might think, another place where Aristotle pops up is you might think of Hegel as a kind of midpoint between liberal Kantianism and Aristotelian virtue ethics.
Right.
He wants Hegel's great genius, which is, I think, like, you know, it's insofar as I call myself a Hegelian, I think I buy into some version of this program. Hegel thinks that, you know, ultimately the good is the best human society is the most reconciled human society, where reconciliation means something like, you know, the capacities that we take to be definitive of us, to express our true nature, our capacities which are like effectively accommodated or expressed or, you know, not contradicted by the objective social institutions. But we're not going to tell you, we're not going to say a priori what those capacities are. And this is where McIntyre gets off the bus, right? It's like, no, for McIntyre, you've given up. You've given up to liberalism once you say, oh, no, history dictates that. For McIntyre, the problem isn't so much the fact that history dictates it. The problem is, you know, you've got to say which tradition gives you the conditions for human flourishing. And
so
Marxists will never say that.
And he's also kind of, in some ways, accusing Hegel of the same thing, that, like you kind of commit to, like, to this Lutheran notion of freedom. He doesn't say this, but this is implied.
Right.
But you don't really commit to it.
Right.
That would be McIntyre's, like, you know, I mean, you know, being he's a Catholic.
Right. But from Hegel's perspective, it's, you know, at least according to him, he's got the best of both worlds, right? It's like he's got the embodied virtue ethic stuff, but he's also got, you know, the sort of like the one of the good things about liberalism, which is that there's no doctrinaire commitment to like a single tradition of the good.
Even though Hegel does think there's a single, this is where things get complicated. If you know Hegel's entire corpus,
he does
think there's a single tradition of the good, and that basically it's going to win over the world,
right?
Through its enablement of human freedom, which is in the absolute religion, which is Christianity, and he calls it that.
Right.
Like, he says that explicitly, and this is where my argument with secular Hegelians, many of whom haven't read all of Hegel, which I'll point that out. I mean, not that I've read everything either, but like if you assume there is a coherence in Hegel's work, and that you know the later reactionary stuff is quote unquote not just a deviation, which Marx did seem to assume. Right. I mean, it's interesting that everybody reads Marxism in light of the master-slave dialectic because Kojève did.
Right.
But Marx never, ever, 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 ever brings up the phenomenology ever, ever. Like if anything, he does to critique it. That's the only time I remember it being brought up.
Right.
Explicitly. And it's in that your critique of Hegel's philosophy in general, which even Marx seems to have thought was an insufficient response to Hegel because he didn't publish it.
Right. I mean, I think you're right about that. I guess my thought, I guess my only thought is that the specific commitment you have to the tradition that will realize freedom is independent of like this general theoretical aim that freedom needs to be realized. Now that doesn't get you very much, but like that does show that, you know, like there are different ways to go at this basic framework.
Right, and this is where I am, you know, I've been skeptical of the people who try to overly reconcile Marx and Hegel, instead of just admitting that the flipping Hegel on his head is trying to redeem the methodology while dropping the ontology.
Right.
That some of the things that Marxists have tried to maintain, for example, that empiricism is self-contradictory. And there's no internal external image. There is no that the being in itself and for itself may be maintained, but the thing in itself and the thing for itself from Kant can't be maintained.
Right.
That if you do that, you have to admit that Hegel found a way to reconcile all that in a at least quasi-Christian metaphysics.
Right.
that does place God, like, people miss this about the dialectics, but Hegel actually, you know, when they talk about Christ, Hegel misses, like, people miss Hegel as actually stating that the dialect between material and spirit is literally manifested in the mystery of Christ.
Right.
Like, and just stuff like that is just I mean, I think a lot of modern Hegel scholarship, with the exception of F.C. Bessa, ignores it. Like, just outright ignores it. Because we want to reconcile Hegel to a secular worldview, and we want to make Hegel purely liberal.
Right.